Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to the Inspirati, presented by Nuvo. I'm Alex Merrill, and for season two, I am thrilled to be teaming up with Canada's authority on the exceptional, Nuvo Magazine, to showcase a collection of international creative luminaries who are sculpting, welding, crafting, and forging a path forward with originality and finesse. We share these intimate conversations to shine a light on risks taken, guts trusted, hunches explored. We share them with the hope that they will ignite something in you. The Inspirati was created for those seeking inspiration and those seeking to inspire. Please enjoy. Between the physical world of art and design that we know and love, one of tangible textures that offer themselves immediately to our hands and our souls, and the digital landscape of imagination unbridled from the restrictions of budgets or physics, a new realm is emerging, a space in between. Growing up in his family's hilltop country home 15 minutes from downtown Florence, Pietro Franceschini's idyllic childhood instilled in him an appreciation and respect for the objects with which we surround ourselves. His aesthetic point of view continued to take shape through architecture studies, first in Italy, then Portugal, Egypt, France, and finally the U.S. In researching these differing schools of thought in diverse cultural contexts, Pietro was actively seeking to inform his eye from as many angles as possible. He was taking the time to ensure, as few do in this age, that by the time he was contributing to the conversation, he had something important to say. Months before the pandemic began, Pietro decided to pause his burgeoning career in architecture and shift his focus to the creation of artful furnishings and objects. Though he understood the importance of taking time to discover new artistic outputs, he could never have predicted that this break would align with world events. Pietro returned to his ancestral home in the countryside to birth new visions that sat at the intersection of classical, timeless aesthetics and youthful, irreverent exuberance. When the time came to explore production, the global shutdown prevented him from meeting manufacturers, and so he turned to digital artists to help bring his pieces to life in surreal contexts, which he shared with a growing following on social media. What began as a digital solution to assist him with creation in the real world has now become an important part of the Pietro Franceschini brand. Pietro sees these virtual vistas as a new way to communicate, one which allows design to soften its grip on functionality and move closer to art. When I met Pietro last winter, he was only 2 years into designing furniture, but his work has been so well received so quickly, it provokes a revelation or at least a reminder. His story serves as an affirmation that the more time and effort a creator expends informing their perspective over a lifetime, the more expeditiously they can express this voice through a new medium. We caught up to discuss why some friends believe his designs have never existed, which continent is calling him to discover new views, the beauty to be found in opposites, and why happiness is a very simple thing. I immediately regret not doing this at Harry's in Florence over martinis. It was a big mistake.
Outdoor, maybe, right? It's like, it's a wonderful day today.
Oh, amazing. So you're in Florence right now.
I am in Florence. Yeah. I'm here. Like, I'm going to Milan tomorrow, but I'm trying to stay a bit more here, like, for until I leave. I have a few new pieces ready, like, I've been working on, like, for the last month. A lot of coffee tables so far, but I like them. Like, a bit different from what I've done before.
Yeah.
I'll show you later. Like, then you tell me what you think.
Are they marble as well?
A lot of metal and plaster, actually. Like, potentially they can be marble as well, but at the moment, nothing is marble again.
Okay, that sounds lighter. Yeah, I know exactly. It sounds lighter.
Yeah, my gallery told me, like, Pietro, we need something, like, very practical to ship for these new pieces. Like, they're all super heavy. So, but plaster is good. It's still very, like, sculptural, and it's much lighter. So, galleries, like, they love it instead of marble, but, you know.
I'm sure. They don't need to get, like, a dedicated crane just for you to move furniture around.
Right. Yeah, and then a marble edition can always pop up. Like, it has to be marble sometimes.
So when I last saw you just before the holidays, you were plotting an incredible trip. How was it?
Oh, to Asia, you mean? Oh, it didn't happen, yes. I'm still planning on it. Because as I told you, I've never been to Asia, which every time I think about it, I'm like, it's impossible. I don't believe it myself. So I think after the Milan project will be set.
Okay.
It's the first, also waiting for a good weather, good season. I think it's the time to go. And there might be like a couple of things related to production in Vietnam. So I'm trying to connect in like, you know, like pleasure, work, everything. It may happen in, I don't know, in a few months, I guess 3 months. So hopefully I'll make it to take the flight.
I'm dying to go as well. Like, I've never been to Japan, and I feel like I've had so many conversations with amazing creative friends who are like, that is where my main source of inspiration is, especially for design.
Yeah, Japan is great. Well, as an architect as well, I must say, I've been obsessed with Japan for a long time. Right now, I'm mostly thinking about Thailand, Vietnam. Thailand as well, a dear friend of mine, Katerina, you know her, like, we talk so much about what's going on in Thailand, and there's a lot of fabrics and, like, a lot of local crafters, and there might be, like, a connection with, I can't say the name yet, but with an American brand, which I may do a collaboration with, and they produce a lot of things in Vietnam.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Amazing.
We go together, maybe.
Yes, absolutely. I've been to Bangkok one time for 4 days and had a blast. It's amazing the things that you don't expect in Asia, where, like, you know, the street food's amazing and the streets are crazy and it's so much energy. And then you get on the subway and it's the cleanest subway you've ever seen. And you're like, how are they figuring this out so much better than New York and Paris and everywhere else?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Don't spoil you too much, you know.
I've spoiled the subway for you now.
Okay, good. Don't go any farther.
Okay, we'll stop there. So let's get into it. This is really fun because we're new friends, so I basically get to ask you everything that I'm already curious about.
Right.
Did you grow up in Florence or outside of the city?
Well, technically, it's still Florence. It's a family property in the countryside. It's like 15 minutes from Florence,
okay.
From downtown Florence. But, you know, Florence, it's very small. So, like, you may laugh when you say downtown, but it's actually, there's a lot of happening in the countryside around Florence. And my family, like my mom's family, had this property, which was like a summer house, which is very beautiful. It's on top of a hill. And it's all a family situation. So there's like cousins and uncles and aunts and like different generations on a couple of hills. So it's like, it's very beautiful. And yeah, I was born and grew up there. But, you know, like I was going to school like downtown in Florence. So it's just, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes by car or by motorbike. So it's just like being in a big car and like right out of the city.
Amazing. What a way to grow up. I know your grandfather was an art collector. How would you describe your family's appreciation of the arts and the impact that had on you growing up?
I've never met my grandfather. Unfortunately, he passed away like way before I was born, but everybody still talks a lot. I talk a lot about him. He was an incredible character from what people say. He was a completely like self-made man. Actually, he started everything in America. Back at the time. And then he came back to Italy and he did many things. He was a businessman mostly, but he loved art very much. So he started collecting art. In terms of art, mostly was painters like Macchiaioli. I don't know if you know them. It's sort of the Italian version of the French Impressionists.
Okay.
I think they were active second half of 19th century. That was the main collection that he had, but he had a lot of objects, antiques. So I grew up around all this like beautiful environment. I must say that, you know, my parents teach me like to appreciate beauty in your everyday life. But also I grew up in this sort of attachment with objects around you, and I learned how to respect objects around me. So my family always told me like it's better to have a few objects but beautiful objects. So like quality over quantity in terms of what surrounds you. But you should come once. It's good to have people around here.
Anytime. That last trip to Florence in the winter, I just completely fell in love with it. I think Florence is one of those cities in a very different way, but a bit like New York, where when you have friends there, it's a very different experience and you get to get out of all of the touristic stuff and really, it's really impactful. It's just, there's beauty everywhere.
Waiting for the next time we'll be here. I'll show you something more that you haven't seen.
Okay, perfect. So when you think about your childhood home and that being the foundation for your concept of home, what do you remember feeling there?
Well, home for me has always been a very happy place. I must say, like, some sort of a shelter, like, you know, mm-hmm. because every time I used to come back home, it's close to the city, but it's somehow isolated. Yeah. And it's all family, so it's like a protected environment. Mm-hmm. As I said, it's almost like a huge garden. So for me, home was always like very a safe place full of games and like play around. I grew up with my twin brother, so I was never alone. And happy place. I have wonderful memories about my childhood. It was beautiful time of my life.
And what were you beginning to be interested in then?
As a kid, I mean, I had many interests, too many interests, maybe. I was that type of kid that, like, you know, you'd start, like, doing something, and then after a bit, you want to try something different. I mean, I was very much into sports. I tried all type of sports. Then it was the time of music. So I was I played music when I was a kid. I played the violin for quite a long time. Not talented, definitely not talented. I could never pick the right note. It was like, I was having a great time with just people around me listening to me, like, you know, faking that they were like enjoying the music. But then when I realized that nobody really wanted to listen to my music, I was like, okay, and I just moved on. I must say, like, the first very consistent interest that I had was when I was not a kid anymore, and it was in architectural school. Mm. There I found a real passion that then became my job eventually.
How did you decide to go? Was that something that you were starting to think about in high school and pulled your attention that way, or how did that decision come about?
It was pretty random, I must say. I was like, no, I honestly can't say that I was meant to do that. I was, out of high school, I was not very focused on my future. I was more like, what should I do? And then, you know, like, I just checked what I was good at and what I was interested in. And also all of my friends, and I say all of my friends were like, oh, you should do architecture. You're good at drawing. You have a good sense of aesthetics. And I was like, why not? Let's do that. And then it started. When I do something, I'm very dedicated. So mm-hmm. I started college in Italy, in Florence. The first year were like very, also the approach here is very scholastic, I would say. So like, you know, you start like drawing classes without computer, like just pencils and all the tools. So you really, really learn the basics, or like old school basics. It's a lot of theory, like a lot of maths, a lot of history. So I would say that those years in Florence really, you know, set the basis for my formation in that field. And then something happened because I started traveling for study. It was Portugal before. Then it was Egypt. Then I went to Paris. And then eventually I ended up in Brooklyn in New York, which was a totally different world, I'd say.
Between those places, Italy, Portugal, Egypt, France, the US. I mean, it's an incredible early exploration to just start being influenced by so many different places with different philosophies.
Yeah.
How did you find the philosophy surrounding architecture varied between those places? And in retrospect, like, how did that combination contribute to shaping your perspective?
This is a good question. I think I realized the answer just recently after everything happened. Like, I looked back and everything sort of made sense. But I think Italy was very important in order to, you know, set the real, like, cultural background in terms of I know what I'm doing. Because, you know, you study everything, like, from, you study architecture from what happens, like, during the Roman Empire to, like, you know, Greek architecture, through all the way through Renaissance and modern architecture. So you're really conscious about what happened before.
Yeah.
And it was very methodic as approach. When I finished my years in Italy, I felt I had a lot of knowledge about architecture, but there was a bit of lack of creativity from my side. Mm. That's why I decided to explore something different. And Egypt came first. I must say it was a very fun project. I went to Egypt for, you know, all of my friends at college were doing projects about, like, homes and public buildings. So I decided to do this project about, it was in an oasis in the middle of a desert. And so I did an intensive study of what the desert is, what the local architecture was. And it's called Siwa. It's a place really in the middle of the desert, like 7 hours driving from Cairo. And I did a project there, which was sort of a home, but in a garden. It's even hard to define with the topology of the building. So that part, like, teach me that I could just go free with my mind, do something that it was fun. So that was very fun time. When I moved to study to New York, I studied at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. My expectations were like, okay, I have a lot of knowledge that I put together in Italy, somehow very old school type of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I was expecting something very practical. So I've not been into, like, how then I could really work as an architect. Reality was exactly the opposite. What I found in New York was an incredible level of academia and very, very conceptual, which was exactly what I needed, because it's really there that I started, like, being more risky about what I was designing, research a lot, and trying to define my own style. I would say, yes, that New York, it teaches me that I really needed to focus on creating my own language. And then it's always about a professor. Like, you know, like, I found a Turkish professor, like Ferda Kolatan, is a very good architect and professor in all America, that gave me that help to find my way. And yeah, that's pretty much my information, because after that, I stayed in New York for a bit and I was working as an architect.
And what were some of those projects like?
So at first it was architecture, like buildings, like skyscrapers and public buildings, not interiors at all. I collaborated with different architects like Thomas Leiser, German architect based in New York. Then Carlo Ratti is an Italian firm, also based in many places, New York included. And right after that, I mean, design, that it's what I'm mostly focused right now, like products, collectibles. It's something that came quite late. It was just 2.5 years ago. And right now, it's definitely my main focus. I also do, like, interiors, but it's pretty much in the background. Like, my practice, it's really much focused on products.
Yeah, beautiful ones. I read that you came across an exhibit on Neotenic design during your time in New York that had a big impact on you. Neoteny is a biological term that refers to the retention of juvenile traits into adulthood. Can you tell me a bit about the implications of this from a design perspective?
That was a very important part of how I started everything, because, as you said, I mean, I was in New York and I was going around, like, looking for inspiration, and I was just very interested in seeing what was happening in the city in terms of art and design. And there was this very beautiful institution, which I don't remember the name, but it was a museum owned by Mini, the car brand. Mm-hmm. It was in Brooklyn. It shut down a few years ago, but they were doing very beautiful exhibitions. Mm. And this exhibition specifically was called Neotenic Design. And the idea behind the exhibition was to, so the curators recognized something that was happening in the design world that he called Neotenic Design. an aesthetic tendency that a lot of designers were showing, of having this type of furniture that was somehow like funny, playful, and they were really very specific aesthetics. So the exhibition wanted to state that there was this neotenic design that was being defined in the design world and was putting together different designers to show what it was. So first of all, I got very, very fascinated about the idea of, you know, like something very active in terms of academically that was happening. So like a new school, a new stream of designers taking shape right there. And I was super excited. And back at the time, I also felt very close to that type of design. So that for sure was one of the main references when I started designing my own pieces, because I'm like, okay, I want to give my take on what neotenic design could be. And so my first collection was, there was many other things involved, but surely one of the main treats was this neotenic character that defined the first pieces pretty much, you know, like chunky, disproportioned somehow. That I would say in my first collection, the other really important element was also the classic component, maybe coming from my, like, you know, Italian European background. But I was trying to find a balance between something more fashionable, more neotenic, that type of aesthetics, and something more classical that could also survive the time, not just be trendy at the moment. Merging the two characters, I think this is mostly what it was researching during that creative time.
I'm sure there must be an interesting push-pull for you being from a country that has such a strong relationship with historical classical craft and then going out to find freedom within that to bring a more contemporary perspective. I hadn't really thought about how it must be interesting to be watching movements happen, because it's so easy to kind of like diagnose movements retroactively when they're in the past. But it's interesting that you found someone who was talking about something that was in process and kind of calling a group of designers together around that, and that you had that reaction to it.
But it's different from person to person. Like for me, that happened really in New York. Mm. I had this feeling that I was where new ideas were taking shape back at the time. But, you know, that's my experience. Like some people feel that like in the opposite side of the world, that was just my time, I think. But New York, for sure, it's very culturally active. Like we all know that.
I feel like that's the purpose of New York. I mean, my parents went and did that in the 80s. I went and did that 10 years ago. You go to New York when you're looking to be at the apex of all the energy and all the references, all the stimulation, and everybody finds something different there. But I feel like that's the purpose of that city.
Yeah, I totally agree, 100%. I always thought there's a time for everybody's life, like to be New York.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, right now, I still go to New York very often. I'm about to go like next week. And it's always a very inspirational place for sure. Right now, I'm looking more like towards different places, you know, to expand my research. And as we were talking about this before, Asia would for sure will be the next place. Traveling was always very important to start the creative process. And every time I feel like I'm sort of settling down and I'm like comfort with what I know, I need to go on and see what I don't know. So that's, you know, so that new ideas come up and something unexpected come up, because that's all we want. To surprise ourselves as well with new ideas, new takes that you thought it was not yours.
Definitely. So you consciously decided to take some time to go back to Italy, stay in the countryside, start developing your first furniture collection, and then COVID hit, which in a weird way is kind of perfect timing if you're trying to like block out the world and be creative. How would you describe that period of creativity and focus on developing a design language when it comes to products?
As you mentioned, like when I started like the designing furniture for the first time, I was based in New York. And I mean, it was a bit out of necessity because I stopped working as an architect, like with the architects I was working with. And I needed like a quiet place to think and to, you know, to slow down, to see what I could do. So I went to Italy in the country house. And then what happened is that COVID started. When I decided to do that, it was not there yet. So somehow it was a great timing for me. I mean, I don't want to be disrespectful. I know it was like a very bad moment for a lot of people, but for my purpose was just the perfect timing, because I had a chance to stay in the middle of the nature, having no stress of missing out something, didn't have to go out. Day after day, I was just like working on my ideas, and everything took shape quite fast.
Yeah.
Quite fast. And it was very organic. I started like showing my works to some people and on social media. Galleries started to reach out. Gallery Filia was the first one back at the time. And then it was all like very fast. I created my company, which was a totally new experience, and started selling like myself and like with more galleries and with more people interested in my work. And that was a great time. And it was also very interesting to see what was the reaction of, because technically I was nowhere. I was very digital back at the time because it was COVID.
Right.
Couldn't go out.
Yeah.
So also starting manufacturing was sort of a challenge. Technically, I couldn't even take my car and go to manufacturers. But then, you know, like,
yeah,
everything happened. Everything happened like slowly. And it was sort of fun to see how different like countries reacted to my products when I put them out there. So I was in Italy, but like America picked up very, very fast. I've always loved Americans for this, because I thought, you know, like in Italy, I feel somehow like people, they need to see that something already worked in order to like jump in it.
Yeah.
Like Americans are the opposite. You like it, you go for it. So America was very fast picking up with my work. People just started writing me, like, it was very fascinating. And then I started putting my products a bit everywhere. Australia picked up very fast. I don't know why. I guess you know, like they want to open up to what's happening in the rest of the Western world, maybe.
Mm.
Yeah, but then all everything came after, like, very organically.
So cool. What was your process around conceptualizing working with all these new materials, and how did you get acquainted with manufacturing processes since you were kind of separated by the pandemic from a lot of your manufacturers?
So my process is looks like this. So everything starts with deep, deep research, because as I mentioned before, I want to be conscious of what I do. I want my work to be part of something broader than just me working in my SLA. So I want to hit on topics that are somehow relevant, or the dream is to make them relevant. So research, everything starts with research. After that, everything becomes very digital. So I do a hand sketch. I hand sketch the first ideas, but like I quite fast jump into heavy 3D modeling. It's a lot of form finding, I'd say. So that's really how the objects take shape. And after that, it's something that I started immediately. I collaborate with visual artists, digital artists. It's something that like 3 years ago was a bit more niche, I would say. Today, it's something that it's pretty much out there. It, with the NFT explosion, we all know like digital artists, people that create like these beautiful, magical, surreal worlds. You know, like all the big brands, fashion brands now work with those artists. Back at the time for me was I needed them also, because as we said, we're during COVID, like I couldn't manufacture my pieces. So my idea of like render the pieces was not just showing the materials, okay, this is the piece. I asked these artists, I mentioned some of them, like I started with Andres Resignier, which is an Argentinian artist based in Spain. I asked to visualize my idea, my objects, but in a context, in a surroundings that could help the object find its soul, create a story behind the object, you know, scenario that could expand my objects into something bigger. So the digital part is very important. And as I always say, like some people don't really understand this. So when they look at my images, they're like, oh, this is real or this is a photo, which is a question that I actually love, because it's exactly what I'm trying to do. If I should like, you know, have a manifesto for my work right now, it's like between digital and physical. Mm. Also the aesthetics that I'm going for, it's somehow related to the digital.
Right.
So it's both that sometimes you don't know if it's real or if it's not real. So some people, some friends think that my pieces never existed. They think that they're all renders. Some people opposite, they think that they are like real, and they're like, oh, how can you do like this beautiful environment? And I'm like, I don't say anything. I like to leave the doubt, the mystery behind it.
Well, there's something very surreal about it, right? Because it's not necessarily that you're creating a surrealist object. You're just taking an object out of context into a surreal context. It's kind of like dream time a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly what it is. I think it's two ways. For designers like me, like through the digital world, we're trying to, you know, to get away from being just functional, which was, you know, somehow design can be reducted to be, okay, it's a chair and you need to sit on top of it. So I think this digital world is like, it's the extreme way of getting away from functional and getting in this real in between art and function. But for digital artists, I think it's the opposite way around. They come from this dreamy, unreal image, and they want to get real. Mm. And I think it's like in between these two ways that you can see what I'm doing.
Very cool. When you were going through this process, did you feel pressured at first to present a cohesive design language with your first collection, or did you allow yourself to experiment quite a bit?
No. And I don't feel pressured at all. Actually, I think that I wanted not to be consistent at first because I wanted to experiment. When I started, mostly I had no materials. I had never manufactured anything before. So I didn't want to pick a material and say, okay, this is my material and just go for it. So that's why I started working with different materials, changing the aesthetics. I think at the end, after all this experimentation, like something more or less consistent come out. But I think my style is not all like imposed. It's just emerging from all of the experimentation that was and that still is going on.
What was your first piece?
Well, the first piece ever is it's called Gold Arch.
That was your first piece?
It was.
It's incredible.
I know, also because it's the best seller so far. But yeah, I think it's the first piece. There are a couple of other pieces that I designed the same lapse of time, but that's the first one that I manufactured. Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah.
Nice work.
Yeah, I hope you like it.
I love it. I love that piece because it is kind of exactly what you're talking about. It's that combination of historical Italian references with a contemporary perspective and a contemporary material that feels very contemporary.
No, I'm very glad you like it and that you're getting the sense of it. Because it also looks like a very simple piece, but people that know how it is to work with metal, and they know it actually, it's one of the most challenging pieces to manufacture because it's very slender and thin and very delicate as well. So it's been like a lot of prototyping to get to that piece. And it was during COVID, which was sort of insane.
Worth it. How big was your first collection?
Oh, it was huge. It was something like 20 pieces.
Oh my gosh.
So the thing was this, when I started designing, like I really designed and I designed a lot of pieces that then we released over the time. But it was like, there was a whole set of marble stools, like very sculptural. And there was a few pieces in metal, like the Gold Arch is one of those. And then there was seats, like upholstery pieces. So I would say it wasn't one collection, but at the end, it was like having three collections in one.
With all different materials as well.
With very different materials, yeah.
We also need to talk about a specific chair named after the amazing woman who introduced us, because we need to honor her. What was the story behind that?
Okay, so that the story behind that is the mutual friend we're talking about is Caterina Licitra. She's a very inspiring woman. You know her. She's a great soul, first of all, but she's very creative. She's an artist. She's a designer. She's a businesswoman. Like she's creating a lot of different things. And she inspires me a lot. She inspired me and she still inspires me a lot. Like We talk a lot about design, about what's happening today. And I really wanted to dedicate a chair to her. The story, it's very simple at the end. And the chair that came out, it's very simple. It's very simple. It's something that she always tells me. It's happiness is a very simple thing at the end. She always says that. So that's the chair. I wanted to do the same thing. It's like it's very simple. It's actually three, four very, very minimal shapes that interlock in a fun way, but it's very serious at the same time. So that chair was done in collaboration with Galleria Filia for a specific occasion, for architecture lovers, which I am. It was an incredible occasion of doing a piece because Filia called me and was like, Pietro, we are going to do an exhibition in Marseille, in France, in this epic, iconic building, Le Corbusier's building, which is l'Unité d'Habitation.
Wow.
That is this massive, brutalist residential building in the middle of Marseille. And the chair needed to go inside of this building. The designers showed were like, their type of design had to be like somehow consistent, like with Le Corbusier's ideas,
mm-hmm.
or like diverging from his ideas.
Okay.
So the concept of the exhibition was showing very like minimal square design from one side and like more organic type of design on the other side, which is sort of a summary of what people see in Le Corbusier. So when people think of Le Corbusier, most of the people think about lines, straight lines, which is not totally true, like if you really know him. But so the idea was doing like sort of a brutalist chair, something very simple and squared, and giving all the importance to the character that could come out of interlocking very simple volumes. So that's the story behind it. And then that chair had a beautiful story because it started there, but then we brought it to Paris with Metaphor Paris, which is a fabric brand, wonderful fabric brand owned by Hermès. And we did several editions for them. They also helped the brand to display the new collection that it's just out in this space. Very beautiful. And that's a special chair to me. It always will be.
Very special for a very special woman. Since we're on the topic, how does the gallery process work for design? Because you're obviously making more than one of something. Do you create exclusives for different galleries based on color, fabric, materials, or how does that work?
So that's pretty flexible, I'd say. Working with galleries, it doesn't really mean that your pieces are unique or super limited edition. It can be both. There are some pieces that are not limited edition. There are some pieces which are unique pieces. The way I usually work is without exclusivity. With Gallery Filia, I have a few pieces that we made in collaboration, so they're total exclusive of Filia. But it's not a requirement. I think it really depends on the project, on the pieces. I think doing collectibles, it's not only about like the number of editions. Is more about, you know, the aesthetic of the piece and the way it's manufactured. So, for example, a lot of my pieces are like all the process, the handmade part in doing the finishes, which it's not practical. You couldn't do like a huge massive production with this with these techniques. Sometimes they're super heavy. It's something that sort of separates a piece that is collectible from what is like normal design.
Right.
Is that clear? I was clear?
Yeah, no, that makes sense for sure. Because you're not creating things that can be easily mass produced, especially with the manufacturers you're using. I know that you've talked about how with marble, for example, a lot is 3D cut now, but all the finishing is done by hand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, marble is interesting. You're mentioning, like for me, marble was, of course, when you do the project and then you start manufacturing, when I started mostly, it was a challenge. I must say that marble was the most straightforward material to work with, considering that I 3D model a lot. So when you get 3D model, like with the robot cut in marble, like you get exactly the shape that you design in the detail.
Mm.
So it's all about picking the material, And the beautiful thing about marble is that it's unpredictable. Like working with marble as I do, which is not with panels, but with like blocks that are carved out with rubber, technically they are unique pieces because they would never be the same, you know, veins, the same yeah. grain of the marble. And it's always a surprise. When you cut it, you see where the vein is, where it goes, how big it is. It takes a different direction from what you thought. So it's sort of a surprise all the time. It's like marble is a stunning material to work with.
I'm desperate to go to Carrara at some point.
We go, Alex.
We need to make it happen.
Real.
So you've said that every work is in some way an evolution or a distortion of the previous one. Can you elaborate a bit on this?
Well, when I say that, I mean that I see my work not as I need to design a chair, so I sit at a table, I design the chair, and when I have the chair, the project is done. It's actually something that started 2.5 years ago and never ended. And so it's like I'm working on some pieces and then I get a product, but the work, the process still goes on. So when I sit at the table the next time, I move on with that project. Maybe to design a table, maybe to design a lamp, but it's sort of like the same process that goes on. It's like I've never like stand up from the table, like, and you know, kept on drawing. So in that way, every time there's an evolution of what I've done before, because I'm moving on, I have new references, but I start from what I did the previous time. So it's something that is ever evolving, I'd say.
It's kind of in line with your mentality and how your evolution is happening.
Yeah, and this is the beautiful thing about products. In my experience, compared to like architecture, it is exactly this. Really, like, you know, when you do like a big architectural project, you need, first of all, like a big team. You need time. You know, it can take like up to like 5, 6, even more years. So when you do product, it's like you can test your ideas right away and get prototypes, get also the final piece. So in that sense, it allows you, like, the physical product is just a manifestation of what is your research at the moment that goes on and find different shapes, different forms. But it's still the same project. I see it just one single big project.
That makes sense. Do you see yourself getting more interested in interior design and architecture down the road again? Or do you think that you're on your path for a while?
But it's a good question. Like interiors, I like doing interiors very much. I slow down a bit now, but I would do it more in the future for sure. I think what is really happening is, it's something that I really didn't go for it, but it happened. It's I'm getting involved every day more and more in digital art, in NFTs, which is, you know, it's something that it's happening now. I was meant to be part of it because of the way I started designing my pieces. So I was very involved in the digital world, like from day one. So that's something that I think you will see some new projects, digital projects. And what I like, projects that are in between digital and physical, which is exactly what I do and what I want to do. And it's every day there are more opportunities in that direction, which maybe it's a more difficult field to define. So you don't call it architecture, you don't call it like art, you don't call it design. We will see. I think that's the interesting part. It's something that is taking shape and it's also changing very fast. So we take the ride. Let's see where it goes.
Have you felt any pressure to kind of differentiate? I mean, I feel like this conversation around where art ends and design begins, we've all kind of talked about how there's too many words around it when really at the end of the day, like, what's the difference between poetry and a poetic object? I guess the digital piece kind of adds a whole other layer to it, but it's kind of like the new frontier of that exploration, right?
Yeah, I agree. For me, it's also very difficult, like, to define, like, not just what I do, but myself, like, in terms of I'm a designer, I'm an artist. I think both. I think sometimes I feel like more an artist in terms of the process that I do. Like, I don't think about, like, you know, production. I focus more on the creative part, which collectibles allow you to do that. I mean, if you do, like, regular design, you can't do, like, a chair that is like 180 kilos, you know? So you need to think carefully about everything. It's like function, like things to be practical as well. Collectibles, it's really in between the two because you use it, but you're not so limited by many things. And this is something, but that's sometimes I actually like to do a product which has to, you know, to answer to certain questions. So to the weight, to be more practical. So I think it's really fluid between the two. Maybe at this point, like in my field, it's even irrelevant to say if it's art or design.
Well, we're also becoming more conscious consumers, not just from a sustainability standpoint, but also I think people are really craving a more emotional connection to the things that they buy in general. It's like, I think everyone has a bit of a more trained eye from social media and how much we're kind of confronted by visually. And so it makes sense that the lines between art and design are becoming more blurry as we're asking more from design.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. That's a very good point. And I think it's very good that it's happening, as you mentioned, but it's not just like people, it's also like companies, the level of somehow education to like some type of beauty is increasing. It's like it's getting more accessible in many fields. It's not just restricted to like art lovers or collectors. It's like it's now brands like the collectibles, which is still very niche because it's, you know, they're expensive pieces. You need a certain type of home to have that type of piece also in terms of aesthetics. But I think now it's getting really more accessible and you see that companies that were not meant to do that, they're now very attracted to that type of pieces. And this will produce something in the near future, which I think is very good. On the other side, what is a bit scary is, you know, like today it's like people need something new in order to sell. You need to create. And you see like this bunch of creatives that like sit like 12 hours a day, like because you need to create something new like every 5 minutes. I'm not even saying that it's saturating the market. It's just, I think it's a different problem. It's like, you know, if you think about the avant-garde, what it was in the modern time, for example, like, so you were creating something new, something different from what was the mainstream, but it was something against. No. So when you thought about avant-garde back at the time, like the immediate word that came to your mind was against.
Yeah.
And it was hard. It was hard. Like you needed decades, sometimes centuries to become popular and to be, you know, to be remembered by people, to be loved by people. I think what already happened, and it's happening even more, it's that avant-garde became like the tool of the market. Like it needs to be new, it needs to be outbreaking in order to sell. And this is interesting because you're like stimulating like to make new ideas, to produce new things. But sometimes it becomes a bit like overwhelming, let's say.
Definitely. And I had this conversation a bit when I was chatting with Tom Dixon on the podcast, but he was just talking about how hard it is to be punk now. It's so difficult to be counterculture when it comes to art and design because movements are changing so quickly and everything is kind of popular simultaneously. So having an opinion or an aesthetic that goes against the norm is a challenging thing to do now.
Yeah, no, exactly. Most of the times I think like the real thing that really will be against now is doing something like that could like survive over time, that could slow down the pace of creation, which became like crazy sometimes. If you think about not just art, not just fashion brands, there's a level of creation that it's crazy. You know what I'm talking about.
It's like the goal shifts to being timeless instead of being trendy.
Yeah. I mean, this opens a lot of questions. It will need a dedicated podcast.
Yeah,
to talk
exactly.
About
We'll just try and embody it in our daily life.
Right.
So right now, do you manufacture anything outside of Italy or is everything within the country?
So at the moment, everything is in the country. I work in Carrara with marble and all the rest is in the Milan area.
Okay.
I tried once to manufacture a piece in the Netherlands, which actually turned out very great. It's a very talented manufacturer, but for many reasons, then we didn't put it in production.
Okay.
I still have it here at home. It actually was one of my favorite pieces back at the time. But let's see. I think I would like, in the near future, I would like to, I'm actually looking for different places to manufacture certain type of pieces. I'm mostly thinking about South America and parts of Asia where you can still find very good quality of local crafters, somehow at a price that allows you to really, really experimenting and researching and prototyping. I mean, it's a bit more challenging because, you know, like you need to be there,
yeah,
to spend time there. But it's exactly what I was talking about before. And maybe to do that, it's what I want to do in the near future, is like taking the time to slow down and be there, like get to know different techniques and build up a project with a different pace from what I've done like so far.
And the places that come to mind when you think about where you're most interested in searching are sort of around South America and Asia mostly?
Well, when I think of South America, Mexico, I think is still like great, great, great. It's incredible. When I think about craftsmanship in Mexico now, I wasn't there, but I think that Italy, maybe like in the 20s, was something like this. So intense.
There's a total connection. It's so funny. I always think there's a connection between Mexico and Italy that people don't talk about enough, with everything from like the way family is important to the focus on artisanship and quality. And there's something really interesting there. I think I completely agree with you. The craft in Mexico is unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable and it's diverse. So you have different materials. So they're very good at like everything. Like they're good at casting concrete, which is like, you know, it's something nobody does here. The ceramic is incredible, textiles, everything. And also like Asia, I was thinking about, yeah, you know, every country has its own expertise, but like fabric, right? I have a few plans for Thailand, like to do some works with specific fabrics. And I mean, the list is very long, Alex. Like I could, let's talk again in a few months and let's see what happens.
Yeah, let's talk in a few months with a travel agent and see what happens. So when I was in Florence, we talked about that incredible book, The Architecture of Happiness, and the emotional impact that the spaces we occupy and the objects that surround us, just how the smallest curvature of a line can change an emotional impact. How do you hope that living with your pieces makes people feel?
That's a good question. Also, the story behind that book, I need to tell you. I was right after high school and I decided to study architecture. So my father's best friend, who's actually an architect, he gave me that book as a present. And he told me, oh, Pietro, if you want to be an architect, you need to read this book. So I read that book and actually it's a very brilliant one. And your question is on point because I think we were talking about this before, like objects that you put around you, they really define not just the space, but your life around them. It's sort of what architecture does. Design does the same in a different level, more in the detail. When I started design, it was during quarantine. Like my pieces, there are sort of two identities. It's like sort of bipolar. But there's something that is like very serious and monumental somehow, like the gold arch or some of the marble pieces. Somehow I think my pieces show that, you know, you need to respect them, like you notice them. Like it's not something that you just, you know, pass by and you don't even notice. So it's something that say, hey, I'm here, I'm important. So respect to objects, I think they teach you for sure. Mm. And then there's a funny twist, there's playful twist that I always try to put in the pieces, which they're trying to make the space around you playful somehow and happy, that makes you smile a bit.
That's a great combination, respect and silliness.
Yeah, pretty much this. But let's see, I as I told you, like there's a new, it's not a new collection, it's a new series of pieces that are coming out, which I think they're exactly like hitting on the same topics, like different declinations, but they are hitting on the same topics. I'm dying to show them to you.
You have to text me. I can't wait to see them.
Yeah, I will. from it.
So last question, in this period of your life, what do you find most beautiful?
What do I find most beautiful? That's a very good question. So let's say I had a very hectic life in the last few years. But it was a choice. I think, you know, like I travel a lot, but I also take some time like to slow down. And this is exactly what I need. So for me, it's very hard to say what I found beautiful. I must say opposites. Opposites, maybe it's what I every day I believe I'm focusing on, because I think like opposites in everything. When you try to create something, you need to focus on opposites. They can create beauty. I think, I mean, from ancient times, like you don't have something if you don't also have the opposite, no? So I'm really studying opposites of all the new pieces I'll show you also. The whole idea behind them is that beauty comes out of opposites. What do you think about this? I can't show you the pieces yet, but does it make any sense to you?
Well, it makes sense from what you've done already, when what we were just talking about around respect and playfulness, but also, yes, the tension of contrast. I think in your life, in your space, you know, we've all kind of seen even just like politically the danger of being in an echo chamber when perspective is all the same. And I think the most interesting things in life, both aesthetically and even just philosophically, come from challenging your own opinion. And then even within a space, kind of having things that challenge each other in a way that makes it more dynamic instead of one note.
No, exactly. And totally understand what I was saying. Yeah. Yeah. This is definitely what I think is challenging my research right now. Do something that you perceive it not as static, but in motion, in evolution. So when I say opposites, at the end, I really mean this. Yeah.
Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I know how busy you are right now.
No, I'm never busy for you, Alex. It was a very nice chat. Very, very nice. Hopefully we can catch up in a few months, so we can talk about the new collection. I'm sure it will be like a nice way to move on with this conversation, which was lovely.
Yes, amazing. All right, I'll see you somewhere soon.
Okay, very nice to see you, Alex. We talk soon. Ciao.
And that, beautiful people, concludes another episode of the Inspirati presented by Nouveau. Please rate and leave a comment if you're enjoying these conversations. You can follow the Inspirati and Nouveau Mag on Instagram or find me at alex.merrill. Stay inspired and keep creating.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.